It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Over the last 3.5 months, the city has experienced a pandemic, a shutdown of most businesses, a gradual reopening, and now a new spike in COVID-19 cases. We're in the offices of Mayor Bill Peduto, and we are properly socially distanced. Mr. Mayor, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's been a while.
On Wednesday, Governor Wolf expanded the mask order. Now anyone leaving home must wear a mask. Do you think this was necessary?
Unfortunately, yes. It shouldn't be. It should be a common sense approach to a global pandemic. But unfortunately, some people have made it into more of a political statement than a public health issue.
How do you think Pittsburghers will react to this?
I hope that they'll react in a way of understanding, which is that by wearing a mask, you are protecting your neighbor. It's not difficult to do. There may be some people where, if they have asthma or something else, will be limited in their ability, but it shouldn't be viewed as anything more than an ability to contain a virus. And everything that is being read into it is not only unfortunate, but will delay the reopening of life as we knew it.
Do you expect it to be enforced strictly?
Haven't talked to the governor about the enforcement component. I don't know if there is going to be a request of municipal law enforcement, but if there is, we will abide.
On June 5th, when our region entered the green phase, what were you feeling at that time? Optimism? What was it?
Trepidation. There was always the potential that we would not be able to contain it, and that's exactly what happened. What was different in the United States than what was different in Europe and Asia is that some people decided not to follow the rules, and they just went back to life the way it was.
New cases went into single digits for several days in June in Allegheny County. In fact, June 17th, there were no new positives reported. Now we've been setting record daily highs this week. So trepidation when we went green. So what are you feeling now?
I'm concerned because of the life cycle of the virus being 14 days. We will have to see numbers that are continually going down for at least 2 weeks before we can even think about having restaurants and bars reopened in the way that they were before. And if the numbers continue to increase over the next 2 weeks, then it will mean closing of more where we'll be back to a phase of yellow or red.
Well, you were mentioning the bars and restaurants serving alcohol on site. Of course, that order came out Sunday from the County Health Department. Many owners have complained that they were following the rules, you know, wearing masks, limiting the number of customers. So was this the right move, or should it have been maybe more strict enforcement against those who really weren't playing ball?
When you're dealing with an issue that is potentially life or death, it's very hard to have areas of gray. It is unfortunate. There are those that not only were playing by the rules, but invested thousands of dollars in order to be able to do so, that got caught into the net of the closing. But hopefully, if we can get this virus under somewhat control, we'll be able to reopen earlier.
Not just as a mayor, but as a citizen, do you sort of regret that action? Because you like to be out there and about among the people.
I usually will be out at least 5 nights a week, not staying out late or anything, but just being out. It's been a very different life for me on a personal level. But I also realize that it's absolutely imperative if we're ever going to be able to control the virus before a vaccine is present. Who I worry about are the folks that work in the food and beverage industry and the people that own their own restaurants and bars. And so what I can do to try to help them is work with, there's a $250 million grant that's now available to small businesses in the state of Pennsylvania. This is a grant, not a loan. to be able to help you to survive through this. We're working to make sure that it's available to all. And on top of that, create a local program that will help specifically those businesses in the city of Pittsburgh.
Do you think we are headed for another shutdown?
My big worry is that when we get to the point of the fall, and if we have not closed out this first cycle, we'll be looking back at this point as the easier times. If that were to happen, I worry about the number of hospital beds. I worry about the amount of equipment. I worry about the availability of healthcare professionals and first-line responders. If we were to get to that situation, it would only be because we failed during these next critical months.
So many iconic Pittsburgh events have been canceled. The Marathon, Three Rivers Arts Festival, this weekend's big 4th of July celebration. You're a native. Do you have a sense of what the mood of Pittsburgh is right now?
Sometimes it's Sunday afternoon that brings us together as Pittsburghers, no matter what race, no matter what income, no matter what neighborhood or what part of Western Pennsylvania you live in, we're all Steeler fans. When you start taking away all of that and you start to isolate people in their homes, I don't think it's so surprising that you see what we're seeing today, which is an isolation of ideas as well as a mood of hate. Hate can be cured through knowledge and through togetherness. And right now we're missing that. And yes, as the mayor of the city of Pittsburgh, I worry about that quite a bit.
It was just announced Wednesday that Pittsburgh is one of a dozen cities in a pilot program for guaranteed income for a group of residents. What will this involve?
Basically, there will be a number of families who will be randomly chosen, who will be given a debit card with $500 in it, and that $500 will be renewed every month for a certain period of time. And we'll look to see how the money is spent, how their lives are affected, how it's changed. We believe that the investment into these families will be such that city dollars that would have had to have gone to the different services that they would have relied upon will be less. And we'll be studying that as well to see if it's actually a benefit to the taxpayers to be able to help people directly. In the conversations that we've had since the past several weeks about disparity, especially in our black neighborhoods, we believe that direct investment into the people in the communities is going to prove to be the most beneficial way to lift people.
Monday in the Confluence, you can hear the second half of our conversation. Mayor Bill Peduto, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Normally, by early July, the U.S. Supreme Court has handed down all of its decisions for cases in that session. But due to the pandemic, there are still some cases pending. However, the High Court has issued some huge decisions. University of Pittsburgh law professor and WESA's legal analyst David Harris joins us now. David, on Monday, by a 5-4 vote, the justices struck down a Louisiana law regulating abortion clinics, saying that requiring doctors who perform abortions must have admitting privileges to nearby hospitals violates Roe v. Wade. Wasn't this Louisiana law similar to a Texas law that was struck down earlier?
Well, that's exactly right, Kevin. In 2016, the Supreme Court heard a case called Whole Women's Health out of Texas, in which that same kind of law that doctors had to have admitting privileges at local hospitals was struck down as part of a package of Texas abortion restriction laws. So here we were back in 2020 with a Louisiana law that was exactly the same as what had been struck down before.
And the difference here is now Chief Justice Roberts in how he voted on Texas versus Louisiana.
Well, that's exactly it, Kevin. That's what makes this so fascinating. In the 2016 case, the 5-4 deciding vote was Justice Kennedy. And when Justice Kennedy retired and was replaced by Justice Gorsuch, a number of people in the state said, now's our chance. We're going to overturn that 2016 case. We're just going to run the same play again. And now we'll get 5 votes for us, at least 5. Well, Justice Roberts surprised everybody. He joined the 4 liberals in striking the law down again, but he didn't join their reasoning. He said, I don't agree with what this decision is in the reasoning, but I uphold it as a piece of precedent. What you're seeing is Roberts defending his institution.
But this isn't the end of it. There are state abortion restrictions cases making their way up to the high court, aren't there?
Absolutely. And it's the same motivation. Since the early 90s in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the U.S. Supreme Court said states can regulate abortion, but they cannot place an undue burden on it. So state after state after state passes laws chipping away at the abortion right to see just how far they can go. And it's not over yet.
Another decision this week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Montana's exclusion of religious schools from a state scholarship program funded by tax credits violates the U.S. Constitution. Any surprise here?
This is not a surprise. What's a surprise is how much different it might look to people of a certain age. When I was coming up, you looked at these kinds of cases, and there was a very strict separation of church and state, no public funding for religious schools. Now what we find in so many areas is the First Amendment being used as a shield for religious institutions. That's what we have here. The court saying the First Amendment gives the right to free exercise of religion, and that is a greater and more important right in this instance than the separation of church and state.
And there was a landmark ruling extending protections to millions of workers nationwide, federal civil rights laws protecting gay, lesbian, transgender workers.
Absolutely. And this really was a big decision. This involves the federal law that protects against employment discrimination. And textually, it says, on the basis of sex. And so the question before the court was, does that mean gender, that kind of interpretation of the word sex, or does it mean something more? Could it include sexual preference, trans status, things like that? The writer of the opinion for the majority was Justice Gorsuch, of course, put on the court by the president as a conservative voice, and he said, no, the word sex includes sexual preference, because if a person is being discriminated against, for instance, for having a relationship with a man, and that person is a man, the person would be treated differently if the person having the relationship with a man was a woman. It is a monumental change. Now, it doesn't change state law, which is often, for instance, in Pennsylvania, much more restrictive. The state law in Pennsylvania does not protect people against this kind of discrimination. And it doesn't change other areas in which people can still be discriminated against, such as housing or the provision of services.
Decisions remain to be handed down on some key cases. What are you most curious about? Maybe those originating in Pennsylvania, over whether employers with religious objections can refuse contraception insurance to their workers?
Yeah, that's a big one still to be decided. The Little Sisters of the Poor case, does the conscience objection, so-called, apply here and mean that the religious organization does not have to obey the contraception mandate? And the other one I'm really watching for are the various cases on the disclosure of the president's financial records. You remember Congress subpoenaed his financial records, his tax records. So did the state of New York, one of the prosecutors there. And the court is going to speak about those things, too.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris is WESA's legal analyst and host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast. Thanks, David.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh is home to dozens of hospitals and medical facilities, from level 1 trauma centers to neighborhood health clinics. Nearly 1 out of every 5 workers in the city is employed in healthcare. 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley takes a look back at how the medical community evolved in Pittsburgh.
The lawn of UPMC Presbyterian Hospital in Pittsburgh's Oakland neighborhood bustles with activity. Oakland is the center of the region's eds and meds economy. But according to Ann Matteratz with the Heinz History Center, that wasn't always the case.
Really, hospitals as we know them today are very much a 20th century institution.
Historically, medical care was provided by religious institutions, which decided that caring for the sick was part of their duty. Special wards were created for people with diseases like leprosy or those struggling with mental health. For a long time, people were treated within these special facilities, until the mid-1800s, when Matteratz says religious women began going into the community.
They actually called them the walking nuns, because they would go out and walk amongst these destitute and care for them.
The Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh's first bishop, Michael O'Connor, brought such women with him when he moved to the growing city.
Within 5 years of arriving, they found the first hospital in the city of Pittsburgh.
In 1847, those Sisters of Mercy formed what would later become UPMC Mercy, now in Pittsburgh's Uptown neighborhood. 1 year later, Protestant Lutheran immigrants founded Passavant Hospital on the north side. Soon after, West Penn Hospital in Bloomfield and St. Francis in Lawrenceville opened. Matteratz says medical care was still relatively rudimentary until health research began to take off with somewhat simple changes, especially around hygiene.
So you begin to get the understanding that, oh, if you don't overcrowd people, you know, you don't have beds next to each other, you put at least 3 feet between them, people for some reason tend to get better.
These fledgling hospitals were put to the test during the region's first major public health crises, outbreaks of cholera and typhoid. Pittsburgh's drinking water supply, Matteratz says, was its rivers.
And the rivers are also a place where sewage is going and where industry is dumping its refuse and waste. So you get these huge outbreaks of waterborne disease here.
Finally, in 1908, Pittsburgh established its first water filtration system so the toxins that caused these deadly diseases could be removed. Decades later, Jonas Salk at the University of Pittsburgh would develop the polio vaccine. Thomas Starzl performed the first liver transplant. Freddie Fu pioneered sports medicine here. Much like the consolidation and mergers happening in the manufacturing industry, the hospitals formed partnerships in the mid-20th century. UPMC Presbyterian Shadyside President John Innocenti remembers these conversations were still happening when he worked at Montefiore Hospital in 1989.
We got better and better. We tried to eliminate a lot of the silos, a lot of the duplications, a lot of the back office function, tried to create efficiency in terms of how we provided the care.
These efforts continued through the turn of the century. Allegheny General Hospital and West Penn are now part of Allegheny Health Network. UPMC continues to expand and diversify its footprint, with facilities dedicated to specialties like cancer and vision care. More than 133,000 people work in healthcare in Pittsburgh. And while the Eds and Meds economy has been touted recently for the city's comeback after steel, it's been an important part of the city's fabric for much longer.
We look at this kind of culture of medicine in this part of our economy as being a very recent thing, but the seeds of it were sown a long time ago.
Matteratz says Pittsburgh's legacy of medical innovation continues as both AHN and UPMC employees pursue research on vaccines and treatments for COVID-19. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joya Zenkovich, and Doug Shugerts. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good day of good news.